Welcome to Consider This Program. I'm Joe Clark, your host.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
And we are happy to have you along. As Ms. Kinzer said, you know, if you listen to this show a lot, one of the things that's near and dear to my heart is what I call defined distribution. If you get a 401k plan or an IRA plan, eventually the money will come out. What goes in must come out. And it's the law of tax gravity is the way that it is. And so, left to my own devices, I spend a lot of time talking about IRAs, taxation, and helping you design your distribution instead of the IRS being allowed to force your hand. Ken has issues at his young age with me constantly talking about IRAs. So we started today's talk off by Angie saying we have better topics today.
I just meant a more diverse, at least not all
politically,
segments.
Politically incorrect. Ken said I got fired up a little bit. It could be true. You know, I dream about IRAs.
It's exciting.
Well, that when you see what happens to people's finances when things aren't taken care of, you're exactly right. So today, Ken, we're going to talk about things that are inside of your IRAs
or
401ks or impact them. There's a three-letter initial that most people on the planet have never heard of. Some will understand it, but we're going to talk about CEFs and their impact in the financial world and how they work. CEF stands for closed-end fund. If you've listened to the show, and this actually what originated this call, I am very particular about my money not being in anything different than yours. So if we're somebody who manages the money here, you will not have anything in your account that I don't have in mind. The exception are CEFs, and we'll explain why as we go there in closed-end funds. We are going to talk about the Federal Reserve and interest rates and what it does to Ken Dilger's business in terms of interest rates and why in the world the Federal Reserve is even talking about having a rate cut when the economic data appears to be so good, at least inside of the stock market. And then we're going to do, and this is why you really need to sign up for the podcast. Consider this program. You do have to add the word program anywhere you listen to podcast. About once or twice a month, I will interview an author. In this case, it's a good friend of mine, John Braddock, and he's got a program called lifeandwishes.com where you can store some of your legacy data. We're going to talk about why estate planning is critical, even for somebody as young as Ken Dilger, and then we're going to go into the podcast. So download the podcast if you want the whole interview. Today, we'll give you a snippet of it. In the meantime, we will take a break and get right back into the show. Consider this program, yourlifeafterwork.com. Consider this as the email address. We'll take a break and be right back.
Hi, Joni Michaels here. We know you care about your money, but are you tired of worrying about it? The Financial Enhancement Group takes care of people just like you who don't want to worry about their money. As fiduciaries, the team at the Financial Enhancement Group will care for your nest egg just like they would care for their own. If they were in your situation, there are many decisions you'll need to make as you face retirement, and the team at the Financial Enhancement Group is here to help you. Call 800-928-4001 or go to yourlifeafterwork.com to set up a time to meet. The confusion and complexity of retirement is almost as daunting as is the excitement of retirement. Don't let your fear and frustration of taxes and investing derail your retirement. Call the Financial Enhancement Group at 800-928-4001. They'll give you a complimentary second opinion on your strategy for retirement. Begin your adventure in your life after work. Call 800-928-4001 or yourlifeafterwork.com. Now back to Consider This Program with Joe Clark.
Welcome to Consider This Program. I'm your host, Joe Clark.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
Happy to have you along. So Ken is the co-host on the radio. He makes sure when I say something that doesn't make sense, at least to him, he raises an eyebrow so I know I need to explain it better. And Angie is the one that you get to talk to when you call the Financial Enhancement Group if you want to make an appointment or ask a question. So those are the three characters that are on the show. We would love to talk to you at some point in time in your life if we can be of service. So Ken, I just mentioned CEFs, and the author that I heard or the question that I got is, what is this CEF doing in my account? I'd never heard them referred to as CEFs. They are the initials CEF, and stands for closed-end fund, and I will tell you that they are not for the faint at heart.
Right? Okay.
So my job is to make lemonade out of lemons, and As you may very well remember, 2008, the end of the year, was nothing but lemons, right? I went through some very, very tough stuff emotionally. You know, try managing people's money in a Great Recession. It was very, very difficult, and I still have battle scars from that. But one of the things that we did was use closed-in funds to be able to make lemonade out of lemons, right? So what happens with the investment world is most people do not understand, and I hate to say that, but most retail investors do not fully understand the stuff that exists in their own account. I just moved, I think it was a $4 or $5 million account from somebody in Florida that got a hold of our radio show and wanted us to take care of their money. We take care of people's money in 31 states. And they moved the stuff over, and I started asking her, how did you meet? You've heard me mm-hmm. talk about Genesis before, right? You know, it's how did you meet? And, you know, how did you meet with this investment? She goes, well, I really don't know. How did you meet with this one? Well, I really don't know. And it's not, I mean, that just happens. It's part of what happens in the world. So when people freak out, they tend to call their broker, and Angie, they sell everything, right? Just sell it all. Sell it all. So you have a list of questions that you want to go through. So we'll hit those and run down them, and I'll quit yakking.
What is an open-ended mutual fund?
Not a closed-end mutual fund.
Right.
And it is the one that was the least used in 1924 when mutual funds were created. By the way, the rules on mutual funds were last updated. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
1940. You know, think about anything in your life that has not changed in the last 5 years. And then understand most of your retirement accounts are in stuff that haven't been changed for almost 80 years.
Wow.
I mean, just think mm-hmm. about that for a second. But an open-end mutual fund is the one that you have in your 401k. You put money in. There's a money manager that's taking care of the money. When you want your money out, the money manager is responsible for giving it to you. Okay? That's an open-ended fund.
What kind of holdings are inside of there?
Could be stocks, bonds, or cash. So some are purely bonds. If you sign up for our weekly market carver, remember here I really talk about economics or what's going on in the market. But weekly I send out a video newsletter. And in that newsletter we talk about what was the most important thing in our opinion the week before. And so we actually have stuff in the market carver coming that just came out this past week that talked about that. But a mutual fund can be a bond mutual fund where it just owns bonds or what we call fixed income. It could be just stocks, could be a mixture of the two, and they always have to have some cash because they have to give you your money back if you call in and say, I want a redemption, right?
Now, how is the value determined?
At the end of every day in a mutual fund, you get a thing called an NAV, which stands for net asset value. So when you look at an open-end or a closed-end mutual fund or a fund, they have a number of shares that are out there. It's actually a trust, Ken. So in your trust, you own 100% of your trust, mm-hmm. right? In an investment trust, you may only own 1%, right? So instead of, and this is why they were created, all the mutual funds were created in 1924, it was very hard to keep track of what Angie owned, what Ken owned, what Joe owned, etc. And so they came up and said, okay, we're going to put all of the money in a trust, and then Ken would have a certain number of units of the trust, Angie would have a certain number, Joe would, and at the end of the day, the NAV tells me what my unit is worth. So it's all of the investments that are inside, stocks, bonds, and cash, divided up by the number of units.
Okay, so cool. Does that necessarily mean that's what you'll get when...
It does in an open-ended trust. Actually, you have to put the order in before 2 o'clock, and then you get the close that day. And so it's, you'll hear them say on CNBC and places like that, the most important trading hour of the day is the end. If you own a mutual fund, an open-ended fund, you're only going to get what happens before 2 o'clock, and if you want to sell it after 2, you're going to get the close of the following day. And a lot of stuff can happen in a market in 24 hours. It's another reason why Joe has never owned, nor will ever own, an open-ended mutual fund. I do not like 1940 rules
right.
and 2019 economic times.
That was my next question, because I know that always when someone comes and they have mutual funds already, and you say you have to make lemonade out of lemons, but you're not real thrilled with mutual funds yourself.
No, if you have a mutual fund inside of an IRA, you can consider it sold if it comes here. If you have a mutual fund that's outside of an IRA with a lot of capital gains and taxation in it, that's a different story. Then we have to massage those from a tax standpoint as opposed to just an investment standpoint. Inside of an IRA, you can make all the sales that you want without having any tax implication, provided it stays inside of the IRA wrapper.
Okay. So then what is the opposite of that? What is the CE?
The closed-end fund is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And again, this is the only thing that I may have in my account that you don't have in yours. So one of the things that we have to look at every day is volume. Volume are the number of shares that are sold. So in a closed-end fund, can I do an IPO, initial public offering, mm-hmm. and said, I'm going to raise $100 million and then I'm going to shut the fund down.
Okay.
Or I'm going to raise $1 billion and shut the fund down. And then I come up with a number of units that I'm willing to sell. So Ken says, I want to buy 10 of those units. Great. Ken owns 10 of those units. No different than in an open-ended fund. You know the price, you put the money in. I'm the money manager. My team is the money manager here at the Financial Enhancement Group. We manage the money. But when Ken wants his money out, he has to find his own buyer, right? So now it trades on the exchange. And this is what Angie kind of alluded to earlier. In an open-ended mutual fund, you're going to get the value as of 2 o'clock the day that you sold. Or you're going to get the closing, you're going to get the value at the end of that day, even though you had to sell prior to two. But you're going to get the real value. That's what the manager is responsible for. In a closed-end fund, the manager doesn't have that responsibility at all. And so what can happen is you have a fund that truly sells at a discount most of the time. So Angie, the NAV, the net asset value, may be $10 a share or unit, but you may only be able to get $9.50, okay? Just like selling your house on your own. It works better if you have a professional
time, yes.
that's involved. So now imagine what happens. I've got a bucket, right? Just like in a mutual fund, I've got a bucket. It's got stocks inside of it. And 2008 hits, right? So 98% of all of the stocks went down and went down hard in 2008. So the NAV of the closed-end unit investment trust dropped by definition, right? Because the shares inside of the bucket dropped. And then people freaked out. They don't understand volume. They called and just, get me out, get me out. And so the brokers then sold the stuff. You had to find a buyer. And we were able to buy some of these things at 25 to 40% discount on top of the discount that the market had already provided. But volume is very, very tight. So I have to keep a list. Adam and Andrew keep a list of who the last person was that had that opportunity. And then the next group of people are able to get it the next time something like this occurs. So we use them a lot inside of the fixed income environment, not so much the stocks, unless you happen to have a whole lot of market volatility where they can become really, really beautiful things. Hey, you're listening to Consider This. I'm Joe Clark, along with Angie Kinzer, Ken Dilger. We got to take a break. You got a question or comment, give us a call, 800-928-4001. Welcome to Consider This program. I'm your host, Joe Clark.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
Happy to have you along. We are getting ready to trespass into economic data, which
okay.
always concerns me because, you know, we're currently toward the end of July of 2019, and a whole lot of things can happen between now and the time you hear this show, let alone 6 months later, right? So right. please take the knowledge and information that we're going to provide in this in the context of where we are, don't think that what I'm saying is, if you hear this again in another show, that it's necessarily what's happening today. So go ahead, Angie. This is your topic.
Well, it all stemmed because we had a question come in, and then when I started to look into it, I noticed that it was a headline everywhere today,
including the Wall Street Journal.
Yes, the Wall Street Journal, saying the Feds were poised to cut rates.
The Feds? Is this like the Cubs?
Yes, it's a team.
Okay. So what do you suppose the Fed stands for?
The Federal Reserve.
There you go. And so what are we talking about? What would you like to know?
Well,
what was the question?
The question is, how do interest rates impact the economy?
How do people believe that they impact mm-hmm. the economy, or how do they actually impact the economy? Because this is a matter of contention, obviously.
Okay.
Right? And it's a battle. So first of all, the Federal Reserve is not part of the United States government. In fact, anytime you've ever mixed the money supply people, which the Federal Reserve is responsible for, with the government, bad things have happened. And if you understood the Great Depression, a big part of it, and it's why so many people in economics were worried about President Trump attacking the trade deals. The Weimar Republic was the German Republic that came out of World War I. And essentially, the value of their currency was dropping precipitously because they were printing cash to pay off the French and Britain people. And so the French farmers who were getting money because of the reparations from World War I would go right across the line into the German country and buy all the food. And the German government responded by printing more money, right? So eventually, people were having to get paid multiple times a day. You would see pictures of wheelbarrows of money going to buy loaves of bread. It was absolutely ridiculous. But that's what scares people in the economic world. So the Federal Reserve's job, their job is really two mandates. There's really a third nobody knows about, but there's two, or nobody talks about. There's two mandates. One is to manage full employment, right? Which most economists will tell you is somewhere around 96% of the people, right? A 4% unemployment rate is not bad, right?
So is that 96% of the people looking for work?
Yes.
Or 96% of the people of everybody?
96% of the people looking for work, or what we would call the labor participation pool, right? That's the big number. And then the other part's inflation, right? So you want to keep this balance, if you will. Well, so the belief was, back in 2008 and 9, when the economy tanked, the Federal Reserve started putting a bunch of money into the system and lowering rates. I mean, they started lowering rates in 08 quickly. Because the theory, Angie, which I totally disagree with, which other people in our office disagree with me, right? I am a demand-based macroeconomist, right? So I believe that you will buy phones when you need phones, not merely based on the price of a phone. Right. If an iPhone got cut in half in price, I don't think you would buy two more. Right. Unless you wanted two more.
Correct.
Right? I don't think a price point makes you go buy things. Right. But some people do. I wouldn't buy another house just because interest rates were very low. Right. Yeah. I'm not looking for, I got a house, like my house, you know, everything's good. But many people in the economic world are supply based. If you build it, they will come. Right. And that's the theory. So when you raise interest rates, the theory was that you slow the economy down. Right.
Okay.
If you raise interest rates, you slow the economy down. That's the theory, because you can't get as much credit and you can't borrow as much money to do the things that you want to do. The problem is it didn't work. Right. We lowered the interest rates. Believe it or not, there's an unprecedented amount of negative yielding rates around the world today on bonds that literally, you know, you pay to own by all definition. They're negative interest rates. We live in an entirely different world than that right now. And it's, people just aren't spending money because of the demographics in terms of where we are. We've got what we need.
But the trend has been to raise the rates
since
of recent.
This is the first time last year in 2018, we started raising the rates a quarter of a point at a time. We got into September, and the odds were, as Ken knows well in the mortgage industry,
mm-hmm.
The odds were 3 to 4 rate hikes this year in 2019.
Right.
In, if you don't remember, 2007 or the December of 18 was the worst market return, which should have nothing to do with the Federal Reserve. Let me make sure you understood that they should be blinded and not allowed to see what the stock market says. But we had the worst stock market in December. Since 1931. And in the middle of the month, Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve chairman, said, you know, we may slow down the rate hikes. And then we had the best January since 1987, right? And the number of times that's happened, for the record, is never. You've never had the worst month, best month, back to back. That's just not how markets respond. Purely driven by the Federal Reserve. By the time we got to May, you started hearing more Federal Reserve chat about raising rates. May, in case you missed it, was a bad month, right? And they went back and said, I don't know. And now you've got the Federal Reserve saying that they may very well cut rates, the president wanting them to cut rates. And the bottom line is nobody wants higher interest rates. Ken, do you want higher interest rates?
Of course not.
Do you get paid anymore to put a mortgage together because the interest rates are higher?
No.
No. In fact, I would argue you get paid less, because when the interest rates are higher, more money's going to the bank and less of the size of the house that they're buying. Right?
Correct.
It's in everybody's best interest to have interest rates lower. Now, Angie, you're going to ask me the question.
So, which question?
Well, I'm guessing that the
from what I was reading, people were really questioning it, saying, is the economy really bad enough to do this? And what the president said is, or not the president, John Williams said, was he said, policymakers need to vaccinate the economy and protect it from the more insidious disease of too low inflation.
And that would be a demand side argument, saying if interest rates are lower, people will buy more.
Okay.
And I will argue I only have so much room for couches. So I only need one washer and dryer, right? It doesn't work in my opinion. And I think that's what played out. And a big part of this is the demographics. You know, 1 out of 5 adults in the United States were born between 1957 and 1961. Do the math, think about their age. They're just not going to go out and buy stuff. The largest generation we have right now is the millennials, most of which haven't bought homes yet. Again, we dealt with that in the market curve this week. Most of which haven't bought homes yet, and they're living on mommy and daddy's couch, right? And in a large part, in my opinion, because of student debt and debt-to-income ratios and things of that nature.
Okay. What kind of things does the central bank pay attention to determine whether they're
going to— What are they supposed to pay attention to, or what are they paying attention
what
to?
What are
right?
they?
They're supposed to be paying attention to hard economic data, unemployment rates, inflation rates, maybe ISM, maybe GDP. They've got a whole list of things that they discuss, and then later they release the notes so we can see what they were actually talking about. But between what we call Federal Reserve meetings, there's a lot of quote-unquote Fed speak, where you have different governors in different places that may make a speech at a big economic outing or at a bunch of brokers, and then the Wall Street kind of runs with their play. It's an interesting topic. If you want to read about it, The Creatures of Jekyll Island would be a great book to read if you want to know where the Federal Reserve came from. Obviously not biased toward the Federal Reserve, if you couldn't tell by the name. Hey, you're listening to Consider This Program. I'm Joe Clark, along with Ken Dilger, Angie Kinzer. Give us a call, 800-928-4001. Angie would love to set up a time for us to talk. We'll take a break and be right back. Welcome to Consider This Program. I'm Joe Clark, your host.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
And the title of this talk is Why Legacy Planning Matters All the Time. Is that fair, Ange?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, I will always tell you as we get into this, and if you stick around in the next segment, you're going to hear my interview with John Braddock, who is a friend of mine. He has lifeandwishes.com, and it's a place for you to be able to go online and save very, very important data. I think he does good work. His story is really, really sad. And, you know, if you're a Simon Sinek fan and knowing your why, of why you do things, my why is real simple: to take care of people who don't want to worry about their money so they don't make inefficient financial decisions that lead to frustration and devastation. That's why we do the show. Mm-hmm. People ask me what we do, and we reduce financial regrets. I mean, that is our job. And that's what John is really trying to do. So if you want to hear the whole thing, you can join our podcast, Consider This Program. Anywhere you download podcasts would be great. Leave a review. Happy to have it. We're going to give you a short snippet of what John talked about in our interview, but Angie's got some questions that she wanted me to hit.
Yeah, one of the questions I got, someone asked, does Indiana have estate tax?
Does not anymore. We used to have an inheritance tax when Vice President Pence was the governor, and it was supposed to come down over a period of time, and we got it eliminated extra early. So you can inherit $1 billion and you owe no inheritance tax to the state of Indiana.
Wow. What about individuals who die? I mean, do they then have to file taxes?
Well, they are dead.
Well, their estate.
To somebody on their behalf. Yes, you have two tax returns that you have to file, that somebody files for you on your behalf the year you pass away. One is the federal estate tax form. It's a form 706. And with the exemptions now at $11.5 million plus, very few people obviously have to have any money that's owed from an estate tax standpoint. Again, none to Indiana, but to the Federal Reserve. But you also file your last 1040. And you've heard me say this before, so you too can take this to heart. When one of the things that I hear said in the financial world is, if something happened to your spouse, do not do anything for 6 months with your money because you'll regret it, right? You're going to be making emotional decisions. That is true of buying a product. You know, don't go buy a big life insurance policy or an annuity from somebody who's selling something if something happens to your spouse. I'm all about agreeing with that. The problem is, If something happened to me this year, Barb's going to get to file a tax return as a married filing jointly one more time this year, right? And then it's gone, right? Then she's going to be filing as an individual, and you have what's called margin compression. So we've had people pass away on Christmas, and I've worked with them that last week with the spouse that's remaining to take money out of an IRA, you know, at a joint return as opposed to an individual return. And it's, you know, people don't think about their money when they've lost somebody like that. I get it, totally get it. But that's our job, right? And it's, you know, we know those things happen, and immediately out comes a checklist. These are the things that you need to consider and move on.
Now, can a creditor come in and take life insurance?
Not usually. Okay. It depends how it's done. You know, the one of the questions I get is, can my estate put me into debt? And in other words, we had a family who the husband was fond of day trading, and he did really, really well in a given year. The good news about day trading is the money can come quickly and
go quickly.
It can go quickly. So because people don't pay attention to taxes, you know, they made maybe $75,000 or $80,000 a year, quote unquote, working, right? And he made $400,000 in day trading in 1 year.
Wow.
Right? Lost it all in February of the next year. Had not paid any tax, right? Not paid any tax. And so the loss in that year in January was indeed a loss that they can write off the following year, right? But that doesn't do any good. The IRS wants their money this April for what you did last year,
right?
So they needed to come up. It was all short-term capital gain, day trading. Yeah, they wanted them to come up with close to $200,000. He has a heart attack. He drops dead, right? And the IRS sent this letter and said, you need to open up. You need to pay these taxes. Well, she had a life insurance policy for $750,000 that was on him. And the IRS said, you have to pay that. Now, I know day traders, and they don't typically talk to their spouses, right? I can't tell you they all don't, but most of the accounts are opened up individually, right? So I called the brokerage firm, found out indeed it was in his name only. As a spouse in Indiana, not true in all states, your estate, his half of the estate, is liable for the debt. Life insurance was hers, right? It was kind of protected. And different people would argue in different ways in that, and different states would be different depending on whether they're community or you know, what kind of property state they're in. I'm not an attorney. All I can tell you is I won the battle with the IRS, and it was a happy day for everybody.
Felt good, didn't you?
I did. I had a lot of fist bumping going on.
Okay, well, the question that we had in was, someone had asked, does a surviving spouse inherit everything if someone dies without a will?
And you were shocked when you did the research.
I was. Yeah. I was.
Go ahead, you can tell them your story real quickly.
I was shocked because I lost my father in 1985, and I had a sister, and my father was remarried, so this was his second marriage, and at that time, your spouse got everything. He was only 42 when he passed away, so
he died what's called intestate. He had no will.
Right.
And back then, apparently, which I was shocked to me because, you know, I got into the industry in 87, but in the state of Indiana today, if something happened to me and I had no will, Barb would get half. Kaylee and Kendra would get the other half.
Right.
Right? 25% apiece. Now, remember, that is only true of things that weren't in Barb and I's name together.
Right.
Right. So things that are owned jointly, joint with rights of survivorship, beneficiary designations, things that are marked TOD or POD, transfer on death or payable on death, they would automatically go. They go what's called operation of law and bypass whatever was in that will to begin with. But it does happen where people have things just in their name. They have no will. And you would think the spouse would get everything. And that's not the case. A good portion of that is going to go to the kids.
Well, and it's divided up oddly, too, because they divide it into personal and real. Mm-hmm. And then in some instances in the intestate succession laws, you may only get a fourth if it's real property. And then someone gets a half if it's personal property.
This is why you need a good attorney. Mm-hmm. It's also why you need to plan ahead for, sadly enough, some of the inevitable things that occur. And that's what we're going to talk to John Braddock about in the podcast that's coming up. Go ahead. You got a couple more questions.
I just thought we would ask, you know, what are some ways you can avoid some of these probate issues?
So in my case, people ask me if I have a will because they think I don't because I have a trust, right? I do have a will, and everybody should have a will, in my opinion. But my will is called a pour-over will, P-O-U-R. And what it says is anything that I forgot to put in my trust, please do, right? As people get older, they make mistakes every now and then. We had somebody that I worked with the attorney and had the trust set up back in 2004 or five. You know, he died this past year, got a $100,000 payment from somebody who owed him some money, went to the bank, forgot, put it in a CD in his own name. And so we had to go through probate, but only over that $100,000. So the key thing is to make sure everything that you have is either owned jointly with somebody else, has a beneficiary designation, TOD or POD, or it's in a trust. People die, trusts don't, until you get to a certain period of time after you pass away. And there's even states with no laws against perpetuity, like South Dakota being one of those. We've got a trust relationship out there. Hey, you're listening to Consider This Program. I'm Joe Clark, along with Ken Dilger, Angie Kinzer. If you got a question or comment, shoot us an email, considerthis@yourlifeafterwork.com, or call Angie, 800-928-4001. She'd be more than happy to set up a time for us to talk. Angie's waiting for your call. Welcome back to Consider This Program. I'm Joe Clark, your host.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
Happy to have you all along, guys. It's fun having you in the studio. Folks, we appreciate you sending in your questions. So if you got a question or comment, make sure that you email us or call Angie. You can reach her at 800-928-4001. And the email is considerthis@yourlifeafterwork.com. We are more than happy to answer your questions. Ken, about anything other than IRAs, is happy to help with filling that. So you're in the mortgage industry, buddy, and
correct.
And again, I don't want to date this talk, so you need to understand we're at the very, very end, at the time of the recording of July. We're waiting for the Federal Reserve to come out and say what they're going to do, but there's great speculation. It's all over the headlines. So what have you seen happen in your industry in the mortgage rate business here the last 60 days?
Some refinances are coming in. A lot of people who have bought, you know, about a year ago, last fall, you know, the rates were in the high fours, now they're in the low fours. So you got people getting out of home equity lines and combining them with the first.
You do know there's two reasons for that.
Yes.
Yeah. The one of the rates is because the rates are low.
Right.
The other one is you can no longer deduct home equity line of credit unless
right.
specifically used for your home.
Correct. But if you can go from an interest-only payment of, you know, probably HELOCs or, you know, high fours, low fives, maybe.
Home equity lines of credit.
Yes.
You know, I gotta, now it's my turn to make sure we're not talking.
Yeah.
You know.
And so then you can lock in low fours and save some and amortize it over the life of the loan. And people are getting out of 30-year fixed and going into a 10 or 15-year loans.
Is that just because of the interest rate differential?
Interest rate. People maybe who have equity in their house and thought about either selling and moving on to a different house, decided to stay and refinance into a lower rate and a little bit higher payment, but you're paying it off a little bit quicker.
So this is me coming clean because I always do my best to be as honest with people as ever. And I always said with interest rates as low as they are, and as long as I can deduct the interest for sure, I would never not have a 30-year mortgage and would probably refinance every 5 years until something changed. And I'll be dadgummed if I didn't sign the paperwork to do a 15-year mortgage.
Yep, there you go.
You know, the last time Barb and I, you know, when Barb and I just moved last October, it shocked me. And anyhow, so we talked a little bit about interest rates on this program today. If you want to, the Federal Reserve, actually, and how all of that works, you can go back to that conversation. Really enjoyed the talk with John Braddock. So if you missed that conversation about how life works when you start to break down and fade away, as I call it, or when you pass away, the things that you need to have ready. John's built a great company, lifeandwishes.com. You can go there. If you can't find it, give Angie a call, 800-928-4001, and we'll be happy to send you the information that's on that as well. So the beginning conversation that we talked about, I want to run it through it again just so you have it. So it's, the initials are CEF, so it's closed end funds. And I have said on multiple occasions on this show that I am not a fan of mutual funds.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of our families found out what an exchange traded fund was, an ETF, We keep all of our money and that we invest in individual equities or exchange traded funds. None of them are in mutual funds. And so he moved his money here specifically because he understood that ETFs were transparent, more tax efficient, and cheaper. And yes, he said, I can't believe they didn't tell me that at the other place. And so he moved the account here. And then I'll be dadgum if he doesn't get a mutual fund inside of his account. So now, as Ricky Ricardo would say, someone got some splaining to do, right? And so he comes in, and I'm trying to figure out why he's frustrated. A closed-end fund is sort of like a mutual fund, but entirely different in our opinion. So you have to understand the volatility in them is much greater than a normal mutual fund for very obvious reasons. And it's you've got to understand how volume works. So this is the only investment that you may ever have that's in my account and not in yours, or vice versa. And we've used them a lot this year inside of the municipal bond world. And though I thought I would never ever say this, you should never own a municipal bond inside of an IRA. It makes no sense to buy something that's tax-free inside an IRA unless the discount is huge. So what happens with an open-end fund that you have in your 401k or your 403bs, you put money in, it gets managed with everybody else's, you want your money out, that fund manager is responsible for giving you your cash out. In a closed-end fund, the same thing happens. Angie and I are going to mix our money together. The manager's going to manage it. But when I want my money out, when I want to be redeemed, I have to find a buyer. And because you have to find your own buyer, and it's, I mean, you still put it up on get a bid from the stock. So it's not like you actually have to go find the person and knocking on the door in the neighborhood and say, hey, will you, we take this off my hands. But what happens, because it's you're usually trading at a discount. You get a net asset value, which we talked about, in an open-end fund and a closed-end fund. But the discount is usually less than what it says that it's worth. I mean, every now and then you'll see one trading at a premium, but that's very, very rare. Premium means the NAV is at $10 and you're trading for $10.20. That's when you have a bunch of silly people in act.
So when talking about the volume of the CEFs, why is it that they have less shares traded on a daily basis?
Because one, most people who buy them know why they own them. Most, not all, right? And that's the catch. And when you go to set up a fund, you know, you may only say, hey, I'm only going to take $700 million. And so there's just less shares to trade, right? When, you know, every white paper I used to read, and I've been doing this for a long time, said that when you cross $750 million as a money manager, you begin to lose alpha. In other words, you're not able to help people as much as you could. Mm-hmm. With the market cap changing today, they think those numbers are off. But you've got a lot of fund families at Fidelity that have $30 billion in them,
right?
It's a lot more money. And so you've got a lot more shares that can be redeemed and a whole lot more money that's going on. People don't open up closed-end funds and put that amount of money in them. That's where that comes into play. So if you're going to own, you know, when we go to buy something, you know, we right as time of this recording, about $450 million that we manage, right? So if we're going to buy 3% of something, right? Because we stay very diversified. But if we were going to buy 3%, in all of the accounts, I mean, you're talking about $13-14 million, mm-hmm. right? That can be a lot of volume that we can't necessarily buy. And that's why money managers lose alpha. You know, this is a whole nother conversation over why you have three companies, you know, that, you know, Facebook, Apple, and Amazon, those three companies are bigger than the energy materials and energy materials and utilities sector of the S&P 500. Three companies now controlled 9% of the S&P 500,
wow.
Again, at the time of this recording. So things change, right? Things change. Hey, folks, I hope you enjoyed the show today. You got a question or comment, email us. Consider this at yourlifeafterwork.com or 800-928-4001. Angie's waiting for your call.